This is the day and this is the hour. The sky is lightning. Lightning over the coast of Europe as we go in. The sea is a glittering mass of silver with all these craft of every kind moving across it.
Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
A beach at sunset.
Many hundreds of thousands of fighting men who are going in now to do the biggest job they've ever had to do. I can't record any more now because the time has come for me to get my kit on my back and get ready to step off on that shore. And it's a great day.
James Holland is walking alone across the sand.
The D-Day story is one I've always found irresistible. Growing up, I was captivated by tales of daring airborne drops and beach assaults against a mighty foe. But as I've learned more, I've realised that much of our accepted view of the Normandy campaign needs questioning. What's more, I think we owe it to those who fought here to get their story right.
Grainy archive film of ships arriving, laden with troops.
I believe the story is more nuanced. That the Americans were not so dominant, the Germans not so skillful, nor the British so hapless.
Troops on a beach.
And I think it's worth reconsidering the events that occurred in Normandy during the summer of 44.
Normandy 44, the battle beyond D-Day. A blurred black and white photograph of a soldier up to his chest in the water.
This is the D-Day image that everyone knows. One of only 11 surviving frames taken by Robert Capa on Omaha Beach that morning. It has provided a visual cue, a reference point that has informed the story for 70 years. It's a story that's been told from a predominantly American perspective. The British effort, often relegated to little more than an amateurish sideshow.
This landing is but the opening phase of the campaign in Western Europe. Great battles lie ahead. I call upon all who love freedom to stand with us now. Keep your faith staunch. Our arms are resolute. Together we shall achieve victory.
General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
After nearly 5 years of war, the invasion took place here. Normandy, on the northern coast of France. An armada carrying 133,000 men would join 22,000 paratroopers in a massive assault that caught the Germans completely by surprise. All too often, this is where the story ends, on D-Day itself, with the Allies taking the beaches. The events that followed are often overlooked. Wars are fought on three levels. The strategic, the overall aims of the war leaders, the goals and objectives, the big picture. The tactical, the fighting. We've best come to understand this through the testimonies of those who were there.
Infantry marching in single file, their rifles slung over their shoulders.
The third level, operational, is the nuts and bolts, the logistical link between the big plans at the strategic level and the fighting at the tactical. It's this aspect that's usually ignored, but which is of critical importance.
And this map shows it brilliantly. Here you've got the sea lanes, the highway of supply. And it's not just D-Day, the Normandy campaign, it's every single day. It's that resupplying of trucks and tanks and fuel and rations and medical supplies. It's that ability to be able to bring that across and reinforce the battlefront that's key to unlocking the Normandy campaign.
D-Day itself, it's the centre of the campaign, it's not the start of the campaign. For Allied airmen and for Allied sailors, that campaign had been going on for years beforehand. So in 1943, breaking the U-boats in order to bring the US Army safely across the Atlantic Ocean as a precondition for D-Day.
Stephen Prince.
Command and control of the enormous shipping effort was under the direction of the Royal Navy from its headquarters near Portsmouth. Stephen Prince is the Navy's official historian.
You are importing enormous amounts of power and people from all over the world, and that requires sea control that stretches across the earth. You're bringing in nearly 2 million people from North America, 1.5 million Americans, but often forgotten the 500,000 Canadians who are so important to the British war effort.
Driving along a country lane.
The Germans were also preparing for invasion. Since 1942, they had been reinforcing positions all along the coast of France, the Atlantic Wall. It was strongest in the north, around the Pas-de-Calais. In Normandy, it had never been finished, and the troops defending the coast there varied in quality. The 15th Army, moved from Russia, was a mixture of veterans and new recruits. The 7th Army had been in France since 1940, seeing little, if any, combat.
We had no good infantry divisions. They had been in France for 2 to 3 years and were completely spoiled. France is a dangerous country, with its wine, women, and its pleasant climate. Troops who are there for any length of time become bad soldiers.
General-Leutnant Fritz Bayerlein had been transferred from the Eastern Front only a month before D-Day. He led the elite Panzer-Lehr division. These men would be in the heart of the fighting. At dawn on the 6th of June, Bayerlein's division was at Le Mans, 124 miles from the beaches.
The task for the German commanders in the west was to defend a huge line that stretched all the way from southern France to the Low Countries. Precisely where to put the panzer divisions to best meet this threat was a subject of a major disagreement that had still not been properly resolved. Mobility and maximum flexibility were crucial because the High Command did not know where the Allied hammer would fall.
The German army in the west on the 6th of June 1944 is 58 divisions. Six of them are armoured or mechanised. Mechanised infantry are called Panzergrenadiers. The rest, the other 52, are infantry who rely purely on horses for their mobility.
It was these static divisions that would confront the Allies as they came ashore. These units would have to be swiftly overwhelmed and a bridgehead secured before the Panzer divisions could counterattack.
A calm, empty sea in the present day.
The landings began with the American assaults at 06:30. It was on Omaha that US troops initially struggled, and it's the fighting here that has so defined D-Day ever since.
The remnant of a concrete defence sticking out of the sand.
From down on the beach, it's easy to think that the defenders hold all the aces. But from this point of view, I'm not so sure. Imagine looking out to a sea dark with warships, all hurtling shells towards you, and thousands of Americans coming towards you as well. This is one of the strongest positions on all the Omaha defences, and yet it was manned by just 41 people.
There were 15 of these strong points along the bluffs. They were strongest where they covered the four draws running off the beach.
In a bunker.
For those in the initial waves, opposite the two biggest exits, this was a killing zone.
A German soldier looking through binoculars.
The position of these bunkers and trenches also seriously hampered the defenders. As soon as the battle began, they were trapped where they fought.
The German defenders do a really good job for the first few hours of the invasion. But they can't reinforce the bunkers on the forward slope, they can't bring spare ammunition down, they can't take their casualties back, and they can't take any reinforcements down to replace the casualties. So those guys are isolated on the forward slope. Sooner or later, they're going to run out of ammunition, and the moment they do, with no ability to bring down more, then they're finished, they're toast. And that's exactly what happens that morning on Omaha Beach. And all those bunkers are falling silent at around about midday.
Dr. Peter Caddick Adams.
As the soldiers hit the beach, they came in range of powerful German machine guns, so identified with the deadly defense of Omaha. The Americans were quick to examine the most recent model.
The latest German machine gun, and the one which is gradually replacing the MG-34, is the dual-purpose caliber 7.92mm MG-42.
The main thing about it is the noise. It's firing at such a cyclic rate, it's got a distinctive noise. And everyone talks about Hitler's zip, the noise, the rate of fire.
To change the barrel, a barrel change lever hinged on the right side of the barrel.
Therein lies the rub. In the heat of battle, this was easier said than done. The very thing that made the MG-42 so terrifying was also its greatest weakness. The incredibly high rate of fire used so much ammunition, the barrel began to melt unless frequently changed.
Okay, gun clear. Considering the barrel's hot, I will not manhandle it without a glove on. Okay? However, this isn't sufficiently hot to burn me, so if we elevate slightly, barrel comes out.
Okay.
Okay. This is where you will need a protective item of clothing, a rag, sandbag, or a glove, because that will fuse the skin onto the barrel. It is that hot.
Interestingly, the same diaries, by the time we're breaching the Rhine a few months later, there's just as many guns, if not more, but there's no comment about it. People had got accustomed to that noise.
The counterpart to the MG-42 was the steady, ever-dependable British Bren gun, originally designed in the mid-30s in Czechoslovakia. Although firing at a lower rate, the Bren had strengths that MG-42 lacked. The two weapons perfectly demonstrate a massive doctrinal difference.
So the manufacture of one of these machine guns, the MG-34, took 150 man-hours to manufacture.
Really?
Even at the height of the war.
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. A Bren gun was 50 hours.
So you can do three Bren guns for...
In the time that you made one gun.
And what about the MG-42?
That was reduced because it's pressed steel on the outside, but it only went down to about 75.
So it still takes...
So it still takes longer than the Bren gun.
Right.
And remember, they're expense items. You use a lot of them.
Nearly 500,000 MG-42s were built. But over-engineering wasn't the problem for these weapons at Omaha.
German gunfire.
Lethal in the opening stages, as the defenders used up the ammunition and barrels began to melt, they became less effective. This is one reason why subsequent waves had an easier time crossing the beach. After the initial slaughter, the Americans overcame the German strong points.
A golden pink sunrise bathes the beach in soft light. Jonathan's walking up a path.
Before the dawn beach assaults, airborne troops had been landed. The British, using gliders, had successfully captured bridges intact, an operation that would anchor the eastern edge of the invasion area.
From a glider being towed to American DC-10s in the air.
The western end was to be secured by American paratroopers. These were some of the finest fighting men in the US Army. But despite numerous practice drops, as seen here, they were delivered into the battle by mostly inexperienced pilots. The result was just 1 in 6 troopers landing on target. Nonetheless, paratroopers from the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions did what they did best and created havoc behind Utah Beach and across the Cherbourg Peninsula. During the first 48 hours of the invasion, panzer divisions rushed to reinforce the coast, they were attacked continually from the air.
It took 2 days and one night to reach the Caen front, and on 7th June 44, I lost 85 or 86 armored vehicles, 123 trucks, 5 tanks, and 23 half-tracks, all through bombing. Berlin, Panzer Lehr.
Competing German commanders had argued where these panzer divisions should be held in preparation for the invasion. Hitler had brokered a fudge that left many units with a long trip to the front. Despite some spectacular personality clashes, leadership for the Allies was more efficiently structured. Under the supreme command of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the chiefs of the air and naval forces were both British, as was the army chief, General Bernard Montgomery. Monty arrived in France and set up in the grounds of a chateau near Croy. He had an extraordinary capacity to rub people up the wrong way, which has often overshadowed his abilities and skewed assessments of his performance. Operation Overlord was largely Monty's plan.
Jonathan unfolds a map.
In his pre-invasion strategy, Monty aimed to secure a continual bridgehead as quickly as possible and then to swiftly capture Cherbourg and the high ground to the south and southeast of Caen. During the build-up, he also repeatedly stressed the need for the British to anchor the eastern flank and draw in the bulk of the German panzers, so allowing the Americans the freedom to manoeuvre south into Brittany.
It's over Caen that a question mark remains about Monty's plan. The city was a vital confluence of road, rail and river, with high ground to the south and southeast. Having taken the city, Montgomery aimed to be at the banks of the River Seine and the gates of Paris within 90 days.
Jonathan walking in the Chateau grounds, then black and white film of a bombed city.
His orders called for the British from Sword Beach to capture Caen on D-Day itself, despite being 10 miles inland.
Dr. Peter Caddock Adams, military historian.
Montgomery, when he takes over, is shown the original invasion plans, takes them apart and says these are inadequate, too few troops, wrong places, draws up a new invasion plan, and it's really his plan.
One of the major changes Montgomery made was the swift capture of the Côte d'Antin Peninsula, but that left him with just one division landing here on Sword Beach. Despite intelligence showing that German forces had increased during May, the plan for Sword remained in place. If anyone had been worried that one division was too much to take Caen on D-Day, they never spoke up.
Who before D-Day is going to dare to turn round to General Montgomery and say, "Excuse me, General, I don't think your plan is quite right, but I think we need more forces in the British sector attacking Caen." Montgomery is really known for being quite vindictive and finickety, and if anyone dare criticises his plan, then there is a chance that they might not be in on D-Day itself.
Professor John Buckley.
The planning process had been based on a certain level of German resistance and strength in Normandy. In the weeks leading up to D-Day, that strength increases significantly to dangerous levels as far as the planners are concerned. But it's too late to do anything about it.
One enlarged division of some 25,000 men might have been enough had a sizeable proportion landed right away. But because of the availability of landing craft, just two battalions, or 1,600 men, came ashore in the first wave. And that was not enough for all that was being asked of them.
Soldiers laden with kit bags stepping out of a landing craft and splashing through the shallows.
Monty may have been wrong about the scale of the attack at Sword, but he was certainly right about the need to build up the number of troops and equipment as quickly as possible.
A large rusting relic on a beach.
But along the invasion front, there was no sizeable port. During one of the early planning meetings, Commodore John Hughes Hallett said, "If we don't have a port, we must take one with us."
Dripping seaweed clings to the relic today.
One of the principal solutions was an effort so vast that 70 years on, its footprints are still here in the water. monuments to industrial warfare.
Dozens, scores, hundreds of craft lying close inshore, pontoons and jetties being lined up to make a new harbour where 6 days ago there was an empty stretch of shore.
At their height, the Mulberry harbours landed nearly 7,000 tonnes of supplies every day. But on D-Day, everything had to come ashore by landing craft. This meant the troops heading 10 miles to take Caen were only lightly equipped when they came up against their first obstacle, a bunker complex, Widerstand Nest 17, which the Allies had codenamed Hillman.
We're just about to fly over Hillman, which caused so much problems for the British as they were advancing on Caen on D-Day.
Archive film of a single propeller plane flying by. Then troops digging trenches.
It was built on a small rise that covered the Caen Road and could not be bypassed. Defended by a regiment of the 716th Infantry Division, not elite or highly motivated soldiers by any means, they had sat on this hill looking at the coast for 2 years and were well supplied and dug in. They held off the British until the following morning.
There's no question that Hillman scuppered British chances of taking Caen D-Day, but there's a problem with a bunker complex like this. It's made of concrete, and concrete roots you to the spot.
Allied soldiers walking over rubble.
While the British from Sword were being held up at Hillman, the Canadians were off Juno Beach, and the British from Gold were already moving inland. By evening, they were overlooking Bayeux. At first light, a young officer led three tanks into town.
We were the first troops in Bayeux and were most relieved to find that except for isolated strong points and the odd sniper, no Germans were to be found. Christofferson, Sherwood Rangers Yeomanry.
Christofferson found the Germans the very next day. As his unit moved south, they came up against the lead elements of the Panzer Lehr. Despite suffering repeated attacks by Allied air forces, the division was now in position southwest of Caen with 232 tanks, including the infamous Tiger. Of all the German machinery that the Allies had to contend with, the most feared was the Tiger tank. You can't fully appreciate the size of the threat until you're up close to it.
I've got to say, the Tiger tank is absolutely awesome. It's enormous, and you can see why, if you were coming up against it, it would put the fear of God into you. But while tactically it may be fantastic, operationally it's got all sorts of problems. Just take the transmission, for example. It had a hydraulically controlled semi-automatic pre-selector gearbox. It was invented by Ferdinand Porsche, and while it might have been great for the Nürburgring, this was going to only cause a whole host of problems when it came to the battlefront.
A tank flattening a tree.
When we come to armour, we tend to think, if we're thinking of German tanks, of the Tiger tank, and it certainly made its presence felt in Normandy. Most Allied soldiers talked in terms of seeing Tiger tanks, and with the greatest respect to all the veterans I've ever met, they cannot all have seen a Tiger tank. The Germans only made 1,500 of them. Nearly all of them went to the Eastern Front. But the important thing about a Tiger tank is it looks powerful, it's frightening, it's got very thick armour, so if you're firing shells at it, bang, they're all going to bounce off. It seems invulnerable, it's almost like a mobile pillbox.
It may have been no consolation to anyone that came directly in its path or found it in their living room, but the Tiger tank did have some significant disadvantages.
To travel 1 kilometre, an Allied Sherman tank uses 2 litres of fuel. To travel the same kilometre, a Tiger tank uses 5 litres. And as the Germans are the ones short of fuel, the Allies aren't, then that limits your scope of manoeuvre for a Tiger tank.
One of the problems is the Germans are producing some of these in fairly small numbers. They're perhaps not so easy to maintain or fuel as some of the Allied tanks. So the Tiger tank is a very dominant weapon in one sense tactically. But the problem is once you break out, the main loss of Tiger tanks is simply they run out of fuel. They can't keep up with the Allied pace of warfare.
A Tiger tank monument today.
It may have been rare, complex and thirsty, but the Tiger did have a really big gun, the 88mm, probably the best-known artillery piece of the war. Key to its success was the fearsome velocity with which it fired its shells.
Explosions creating billowing clouds of dust and debris.
What's often forgotten is that there was another gun, the 17-pounder, which packed an even greater punch. And it was British.
I'm going to have a go at this.
So you just hop onto the seat here.
That's right.
Feet down.
Yep.
They were smaller than me. Than
those they were.
I tell you what, it's easy to move from left to right, isn't it? I mean, this is not difficult at all. I can see that very easily.
Everything on here, it's engineered, it's tough, it's designed to last, and to do the job.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. And the fact that these guns were still being used in Korea 10 years later.
When you're shooting at tanks with armour-piercing rounds, you want a round that is going as fast as possible when it hits the target. And this is putting a round out at about 1,965 miles an hour. That's very fast.
That is really, really quick.
And ready to fire. Fire! Fire!
Health and safety and common good manners meant we were unable to fire live rounds onto a small Buckinghamshire town, so these are just blanks. When doing it for real, the anti-tank gun is dragged into position to engage a moving target and fired at a flat trajectory. The 17-pounder could also be mounted onto a Sherman Firefly, making this usually undergunned tank a serious threat to the Tiger. But if the Tiger broke through, the damage could be considerable.
Jonathan driving an old army 4x4 through a town.
7 days after D-Day, elements of the 22nd Armoured Brigade reached the town of Villa Bocage, where they were ambushed. A 30-year-old tank commander named Michael Wittmann set about an impulsive attack, unsupported by infantry, and in just 15 minutes, destroyed 14 British tanks, 15 personnel carriers, and 2 anti-tank guns. Wittmann, a Waffen-SS officer, was one of the highest-scoring panzer aces of the war. He'd been awarded the Knight's Cross with oak leaves for his actions at the Battle of Kursk on the Eastern Front.
You get people like Wittmann on the German side. Wittmann talked about knocking out 135 Allied tanks. We didn't do that. I was always lead tank. And so I would get my whole troop to fire. So consequently, if we knocked out a tank, it wasn't Lieutenant Render's tank or Sergeant Jackson's tank or any of that. It was 5 troop. We never claimed sort of individual tanks being killed.
The losses that the Germans suffer battling in Villa Bocage is often overlooked. A number of the Tiger tanks are actually wasted in urban fighting in the town of Villa Bocage on the afternoon of the 13th of June because they're sent in without infantry support. A clever commander does not send an open country tank like the Tiger into the centre of a town without proper infantry support.
Wittmann's actions at Villa Bocage were of little strategic consequence, but became a propaganda coup, and he was promoted to Hauptsturmführer, an SS captain. He received the swords to his Knight's Cross from Hitler on the 1st of August. Only a week later, Wittmann's luck finally ran out. He was killed by a 17-pounder fired from a Sherman Firefly. Wittmann is buried with the crew of Tiger 007 at Lacombe Cemetery outside Bayeux. real significance of Villa Bocage is it signalled the stiffening of German resistance to the British advance. What followed was a long attritional battle around Caen. Things were not going much better for the Americans as they moved into terrain very different from the open land of the British sector.
It's amazing just how much the countryside's changed. Gone are the big, wide open fields, and suddenly lots of little tight squares lined with thick hedgerows. And up ahead, you can see the big ridges around St. Lô, and this is where the Americans are heading.
The further US forces pushed south from their beaches, the deeper they were drawn into the Norman hedgerows.
A farmer trundling along a grassy track in the sunshine.
Through every hedge was a new field, a new battleground, and inevitably, a new ambush.
Infantry advancing.
They were becoming bogged down in the Bocage.
Infantry and tanks needed to operate together. The trouble was, these hedgerows were so thick, not even a Sherman could get through them, and the infantry were getting decimated. An urgent solution was needed, and this came at the hands of classic American ingenuity.
Soldiers running through hedgerows.
The commander of the US 5th Corps demanded his men solve the hedgerow problem. In one of his units was Curtis Coolin, a National Guardsman who in civilian life had worked in a garage. He came up with a novel solution.
In a workshop.
Morning!
Morning.
Oh, yeah.
Hey.
We're going to try and make a hedge cutter, and what's this bit here?
We're cutting out the leading edge.
Okay.
So if we look at this, the point would go down into the bottom of the hedge, and then as the roots, as it came in contact with the roots, would shear the roots off and then push through the hedge.
Got
as
you.
Opposed to riding up and exposing the soft underbelly of the tank.
And how easy a job is this? I mean, obviously, you know, you've got all the kit here today, but I mean, is it quite straightforward?
You know, we've seen pictures and photographs of what was made back in the war, and so it's basically a copy of that.
Right.
Coolin's idea was as economical as it was effective. He sourced the raw material for the cutters from the German obstacles covering the invasion beaches. Within 2 days, he had his first prototype.
How many hours do you think it's going to take, all in all, the whole thing? From thinking about it to getting it on the front of a Sherman?
Probably the first one would take a little bit longer, obviously, because you've got to think of the design. But once they made one or two of them, I would have thought half a day, sort of day's work to do it. Obviously, if they got plenty of men cutting different pieces out.
Sure.
Coolin's design had to be simple enough that welders without great skill could mass-produce the cutters in the field, where they were needed.
A section of iron is cut in two.
Perfect. Yeah, not the smoothest cut, but...
It took all of us 3 days to build a cutter and attach it to the Sherman.
The tank on the move.
It took Sergeant Curtis G. Coolin Jr. a week before his prototype was ready to be demonstrated in front of General Omar Bradley, commander of the whole US First Army. We're using the same technique as Coolin. Attach a cutter to the front of a tank, drive it at a hedge, and see if it works.
The modified tank bursts through the hedge to the other side.
And it was seeing a demonstration like that that convinced Bradley this was the way forward. Within 2 weeks, 60% of all US Shermans in Normandy had been adapted with Coolin's hedge cutter.
A photograph of a stern-faced Coolin.
Coolin was awarded the Legion of Merit for his invention. He survived Normandy, only to lose a leg in the Battle of the Hurtgen Forest that winter.
A peaceful field.
Sitting here now, it may seem trivial to be celebrating the hedge cutter. After all, at the tactical level, all Coolin had done was find a pragmatic solution to an immediate problem. but scale it up to the operational level, and it's impossible to calculate the number of lives and resources saved by this simple cutting tool. The combination of ingenuity on the ground and fast-moving flexibility within the American command structure ensured its troops could move forward at a far lower human cost.
Caen, the capital of Normandy and the birthplace of William the Conqueror. It was around this medieval city that the crux of the battle was played out. Montgomery's plan to take the city on D-Day may have failed, but as the British advanced, the area became a magnet for tanks. On no other front had so much German armour been concentrated into such a small area as it was around Caen.
A view of houses surrounded by fields.
Fighting less than 10 miles from the beaches and their main point of supply gave the British a massive operational advantage over the Germans that would prove decisive.
General Fritz Bierlein, interviewed in 1946.
The higher commanders were happy that the German divisions had held up for so long, not realizing that what was happening was good strategy for the Allies.
Professor John Buckley.
Unfortunately, in terms of the movement, in terms of the map, it doesn't look as though much is being achieved. And for many of the troops who are still stuck in positions after a number of weeks in Normandy and around Caen, it's not looking too good. The reality is, of course, it's working really well and the Germans are suffering really badly. And the German strategy consigns them to a long-term defeat, which they cannot recover from.
Allied war leaders in London and Washington were following lines on a map that appeared to be barely moving. To them, this didn't look much like success.
It's amazing when you're in the plane like this and you can look out and there's the sea and there's Sword Beach down there and Caen just over here, and it's so close, and you can imagine how the Allied planners, when you're looking on the map and when you're flying over it for those reconnaissance photographs, it must have felt like such a short distance. It must have seemed such an achievable goal, I suppose, to get there in one day.
A country lane under cotton wool clouds.
But the British hadn't got there in a day, so a new plan was needed. The panzers had been drawn in around Caen, and that determined where the Allies would fight them. All that now mattered was annihilating the cream of the German army in the west.
A German soldier in an armoured vehicle gives a signal to move on.
It's often been portrayed that the Allies were beating their heads against a brick wall of German panzer divisions, when actually it was the other way round. By 1944, the Allies had worked out how to defeat the enemy forces in the field. For all the Germans' much vaunted tactical flair, they could always be relied upon to counterattack, and in so doing, exposed themselves to the overwhelming Allied firepower. What the Allies had to do was probe forward, defeating as much of the enemy as possible, then sit back and wait for the inevitable response.
Typical of the fighting that followed was that near Tilly, to the west of Caen.
The road into Tilly is a road of devastation. It's lined at intervals with soldiers' graves, each grave with a rough wooden cross at its head, sometimes a cross just hastily made from two sticks cut from a hedge and nailed together. The farmhouses, the cottages, almost every building along the road, they're either gutted out or smashed up by shell fire. Every yard of this road was shouting at you that it had been fought for bitterly.
The Sherwood Rangers' yeomanry again found themselves fighting the Panzer Lehr.
The CO's tank had received a direct hit from a heavy shell, which had instantly killed Major Laycock, who'd been acting colonel since Anderson had been wounded on D-Day.
The colonel had just been killed. We lost three colonels in 5 days in the Sherwood Rangers. So the next one down was Stanley Christofferson.
And then my father, assumed command of the regiment. And this was probably after 4 days of, really very stiff fighting.
Three senior officers killed and one officer and one sergeant wounded by the same shell. This was indeed a shattering blow.
This is
Christofferson's son, has returned to the small Norman hilltop his father held with the Sherwood Rangers for most of that June.
David Christofferson.
I can really imagine what it must have been like, James. And it, in a funny way, brings a slight lump to my throat. You can just imagine how exposed you are when you're sitting on a hill in your tank. 0.103, I think, was possibly one of the, you know, the most sort of unpleasant experiences, and certainly from Dad's recollection of it, that they went through in almost all the war, really.
We felt rather naked and lonely on this high ground without infantry protection. Being the senior squadron leader, I took control of the regiment, feeling utterly dejected and shocked. Christofferson, Sherwood Rangers Yeomanry.
I came to Normandy with Dad. I have vivid recollections of, you know, our time here.
A photo of David as a boy, looking up at his dad.
And I also then do remember going to visit the cemetery. You know, my father, who was always rather good fun, suddenly became, you know, rather sort of reserved and very silent. My father really didn't, like so many, talk about, you know, his experiences, I think, which was very typical of that generation. And it was only in really later life where, you know, having read his diaries, did I really understand what had gone on.
John Hanson Lawson, B Squadron commander, tried to stalk a German tank, which appeared to be dead. However, a Mark IV shooting from the flank brewed him up. John and Sergeant Crooks were both wounded. Sergeant Crooks was in a bad condition, but when I spoke to him, he smiled and told me that he suffered no pain. He died very shortly afterwards. Christofferson, Sherwood Rangers Yeomanry.
This is where they all were, you know?
I know, 70 years ago, almost to the day.
Almost?
I mean, it is almost to the day, isn't it?
There's a lot of talk about heroes today, and I've no doubt, I suppose, in some people's eyes, they are heroes. But, I mean, we didn't have any heroes in the Sherwood Rangers. I might tell you that if you said to Stanley Christofferson or any of those people, do you know what? I think I did rather well today. I mean, we got a tank and we took 30 prisoners. I mean, that was jolly good, wasn't it? You know, you wouldn't half come in for a ticking off.
The Sherwood Rangers could have never maintained action at this furious pace without the Allies' massive operational support. Each day, they were replacing killed and wounded men, as well as damaged tanks, in a manner that was impossible for the Germans.
There were three regiments in the brigade, and each regiment had 50 tanks, so there were 150 tanks. Well, to keep 150 tanks going, they had to supply us with 1,073 new ones. 1,073 to keep 150 going. I mean, I came out of three. I didn't lose the last one, but I came out of three tanks. And that was nothing. Don't forget, Stanley Christofferson in the desert came out of five tanks in one day.
Another veteran of the desert was General Beierlein.
Half of my division was still at Tilly-sur-Seille, and had had 4 weeks severe fighting with the British. I explained the condition of my division and that, so far as strength was concerned, it was not in a position to make a counter-attack. At Tilly-sur-Seille, we had been attacked every second day and had been continually subjected to artillery fire. Beierlein, Panzer Lehr.
3 weeks after D-Day, Montgomery had finally built up enough strength to launch a major set-piece assault on the German line at Caen. The result, though hardly conclusive, had far-reaching consequences.
Operation Epsom might not have achieved a decisive breakthrough, but when the Germans desperately flung their panzer divisions into the battle, so went their last chance of a massed counterattack against the Allies on their own terms.
My men went to war weeks ago with fresh, blooming faces. Today, muddy steel helmets shade emaciated faces whose eyes have, all too often, looked into another world. They present a picture of deep human misery. The division's front is stretched to breaking. Reserves are no longer available. I cannot stand this anymore. Dietrich, 1st SS Panzer Corps.
The British opposite them were also suffering. Having lived through the slaughter of 1418, Allied leaders were determined to fight a modern, technologically driven war. But exposing the infantry and armour was unavoidable. And for these mostly conscripted troops, the odds were appalling. Maintaining morale was essential.
The Allies thought long-term, thought about how are we going to win the war rather than how we're going to win this particular battle. But if you maintain your army and keep it functioning over the entirety of a campaign, you're much more effective than if you throw everything at the first few weeks and then just hope something turns up for later on.
On July the 12th, the millionth Allied soldier arrived in Normandy. It was not simply about increasing numerical advantage of the fighting force. With each new arrival, so grew the demands of supply.
So the British and the Americans, Canadians invest heavily in medical support, for example. They invest heavily in logistical support, making sure there's enough supplies. They rotate the units out of the line. They maintain links with home, with newspapers and letters, put great emphasis on that, and maintaining morale. Montgomery was acutely aware that his forces were often inexperienced. They weren't battle-hardened the way the Germans were.
Battle-hardened or not, this vast mass of men required 3 million meals a day. And that's before the Allies started shipping ammunition, weapons, tanks, trucks, fuel, everything that was running so desperately short for the German army.
The story of the Normandy campaign is the Allied system builds up and functions better and better over time and sustains ever-growing numbers of people. Whereas the German system starts off relatively strong, and the Germans are very, very good at their tactical fighting and their tactical firepower. But increasingly, they solve crises in Normandy by borrowing from support troops, by patching up solutions, which is very effective for the first stage of the campaign and holds us close to the beaches for much longer than we expected. But all the time, their system is weakening while ours is growing stronger. And then at the end of July, our system bursts through theirs and theirs has no ability to react fast enough for Allied troops who are well supplied and are travelling in motor vehicles.
Dramatic aerial footage filmed from the underside of a strafing bomber showing a train, truck and a railway line exploding below.
The Germans were struggling to supply their front, mainly because Allied aircraft ruled the skies, attacking anything that moved. And Monty's assaults continued.
Operation Goodwood was launched on the 18th of July, with armoured divisions advancing after a huge air, naval and artillery bombardment. It was designed as the first part of a two-fisted punch to draw in the Germans before the Americans attacked around St. Lo. But after 7 miles, the advance ran out of steam.
Montgomery had sold Goodwood as a massive killer blow, largely as a ploy to get the air forces to supply the bombers he felt he needed. When the attack petered out, Eisenhower's aide, Harry C. Butcher, witnessed Ike's frustration.
Ike said yesterday that 7,000 tons of bombs dropped in the most elaborate bombing of enemy frontline positions ever accomplished. Only 7 miles were gained. Can we afford 1,000 tons of bombs per mile? The air people are completely disgusted with the lack of progress.
Disgusted was an understatement. Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur Tedder, who loathed Monty, tried to get him sacked.
Last evening, about 9, Tedder phoned Ike and said that the British Chiefs of Staff would support any recommendation that Ike might care to make with respect to Monty for not succeeding with his big 3-armored division push. Butcher, Chafe.
Monty was very good at talking to his soldiers or the press, but terrible at communicating with his peers and superiors, especially Eisenhower, whom he often left in the dark.
One of the enduring legacies of the Normandy campaign is the underwhelming performance of the British. To a large extent, Monty himself is to blame for this perception.
If he'd bothered to explain his real intentions for Goodwood, where 400 tanks had been knocked out, there wouldn't have been such a storm. This has always been seen as British ineptitude, but ignores the fact that 3/4 of them were fixed and back in action within days.
because Montgomery is a difficult customer, it's kind of got in the way of any kind of real assessment of what the British Army achieved in Northwest Europe in 44-45. This is not to say that Montgomery's personality does not generate problems and difficulties and friction. At times it does. Overall, there are far more positives than there are negatives.
Monty was focused purely on the battle in Normandy. He didn't see the mounting problems facing Eisenhower as his concern.
A V-1 missile in the air.
With London under attack by V-1s, there was great pressure on Ike to capture the rocket launch sites still out of reach in northern France.
It explodes behind trees in the city.
There was further pressure to match the great strides being made by the Red Army in the east. There, Hitler could trade space for time. In Normandy, of far greater strategic importance, he had no such luxury. The Germans' determination to keep fighting close to the coast has been seen as evidence of their tactical skill. But the two don't always go hand in hand.
One of the things that's supposed to be so good about the Germans is their tactical flexibility, the sort of the Kampfgruppe and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, the British are doing battle groups just as easily as the Germans.
I don't know if it's quite as easily, but they certainly are learning during the campaign. And the example of things like perhaps the Guards Armour Division, who are first in action on a large scale at Operation Goodwood, and they fight, for various doctrinal and training reasons, very largely as a tank brigade and as a mobile infantry brigade, fairly separately. But after that battle, they are regrouping themselves. So you put an armoured regiment next to a motorised infantry regiment, and they work together in intimate support.
On D+49, the Americans had launched Operation Cobra, the second part of the Allies' two-fisted assault. More than 3,000 aircraft pummeled German positions around St. Lo. Once again, the Panzer Lehr were moved to face the attack.
100% casualties in the front line. On 24th, 25th July, I lost about 2,000 men, either dead or missing from the bombing. I collected the few reserves we had north of La Chapelle-en-Ugey and tried to re-establish the old line. I received more infantry and put about 800 to 1,000 men in the line. The next day, they too were destroyed. I don't believe hell could be as bad as what we experienced.
A photo of a tank on its side in a lane, then Jonathan in the same spot in the present.
Already overstretched, defending their position south of Caen, the Germans were simply unable to hold off the massive American attack as well. By the end of July, German resistance was finally crumbling.
I observed the whole bombardment. Artillery positions were blasted. The front line was wiped out. All communications were completely destroyed, and there was no possibility of moving along the roads. I have been at all the hotly contested points on various fronts, but these 3 days at Saint-Lô were the worst I have ever experienced. Bayerlein, Panzer Lehr.
From Jonathan driving in the Army 4x4, to a photo of the devastation behind German lines, a trench filled with dead horses and debris.
By now, the German line was collapsing everywhere.
A man says, "We were forced to retreat every day, every day."
Johannes Berner, a new paratrooper recruit with the 3rd Fallschirmjäger Division, had arrived at Saint-Lô just after D-Day. On D+62, along with all the remaining German reserves in Normandy, he was thrown into yet another disastrous counterattack, the survivors of which were forced back onto ground near the town of Falaise. The end was inevitable.
We were surrounded in the Falaise pocket the morning of August 19th. Tanks everywhere. There were lots of tanks. They didn't stop shooting. And the planes, they dropped bombs as well. There were dead bodies. There were so many dead bodies. We walked on them. We walked on them, yes. A photograph of corpses by the wheels of a truck. We arrived at San Lu on the 12th of June. We were 120 men in our company. 120. 9 of us got out of the pocket at Falaise. The rest were killed.
Johannes Berner was captured amidst the wreckage of the Falaise pocket. As a POW, he worked on a farm near Bayeux. He married a French woman, and for most of the 70 years since D-Day, Berner has lived quietly in the little town just behind Sword Beach.
A young family on the beach in the present day, an archive film of tanks and foot soldiers on the move.
The Normandy campaign was over. Two German armies had hemorrhaged men and machinery until they could simply resist no longer. Traditionally, this has been a tale of heroic Allied struggle against seemingly impossible odds in the early hours of the invasion. But Normandy had, in fact, been won by tactical ingenuity and a vast operational machine supplying an army now able to adapt its strategic aims to a rapidly changing battlefield.
There are 77 days in the Normandy campaign, and the British Army and the American Army that land on D-Day, the 6th of June, are very different to those who leave on the 20th, 21st of August. In the First World War, the armies have to adapt, and it takes them 4.5 years from 1914 to 1918. In Normandy, they're going through the same transition, but that's squashed into 2.5 months.
Montgomery reckoned the campaign would last for 90 days. They'd beaten his target by nearly 2 weeks, and then advanced with spectacular speed. It's true the fighting at the tactical level had played out very differently from what had been expected.
But in terms of the broader strategy, the campaign had more than fulfilled its aims. By D plus 90, Paris had been liberated, and Allied forces were as far as Brussels.
A factory bordered by fields.
The price had been terrible. On every day of the Normandy campaign, casualties averaged 6,500 men. Men whose stories are not told by Hollywood or in history books. Faces staring at us from faded photographs. Names on long-forgotten lists. As the generation who fought here slips quietly away, it's left to us to try and tell a more complete story, so we might understand what they went through in Normandy during the summer of 44.
The blurred black and white Robert Capa photograph of the D-Day soldier, chest deep in the water, his eye focused on what's ahead.